This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
The world is at war. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin launched a full-scale war in Ukraine, and Ukrainians are fighting back. It's a war with serious implications for Europe and for NATO more broadly. Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Joshua Taylor.
Thanks for having me.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
This is a dramatic fulfillment of a prophecy that the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been talking about for years, some aspects of it for nearly two decades and even longer. He actually said Putin would invade Ukraine as part of a broader effort to reconstitute the Soviet Empire. So to longtime Trumpet readers, events this week came as no surprise, and it truly does demonstrate the accuracy and effectiveness of prophetically based news analysis. It also gives a clear idea of what many of the longer-term effects of the events of this week will be. In the first half of the program today, we're going to focus on several aspects of this story, what's happening in Ukraine and some of the reactions and the wider repercussions. We'll start with a look at the invasion itself from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we've been talking for months on the show about Russia's military buildup around Ukraine. And this week we learned that this was not just theatrics. It isn't just saber rattling. This is war. The first big development was actually on Monday. That's when Russian President Vladimir Putin publicly said Ukraine should not exist as a separate nation. And he officially recognized the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk. Those are two Ukrainian regions in the east of the country. They are ethnically Russian for the most part, and they've actually been under de facto Russian control since 2014, just after Putin annexed Crimea from Ukraine. But Putin had refrained until now from formally recognizing these two regions as independent. So on Monday, he recognized their independence and then immediately began sending Russian forces, which he called peacekeepers, into these areas. And so it still seemed at that time like it might remain kind of a small-scale invasion of territory that had already been under Russian control. It was alarming and a jarring development, but to many onlookers, it didn't seem necessarily catastrophic. But then as the week went on, more and more of the Russian tanks and troops that were still outside of Ukraine were put into position for invasion. And then yesterday, just before dawn in Ukraine, those Russian troops and tanks began invading the country from multiple directions all at once, from the north in Belarus, from the south in Crimea for the most part, and then from the east, of course, which is Russia proper there. So this was a broad attack along three main fronts. There were volleys of cruise missiles, artillery, and other weapons. Putin said they would only be targeting military infrastructure in various cities, but the Russians actually bombarded towns and villages and cities as they pushed toward the capital of Kyiv. Russian forces also entered Chernobyl, and they seized control over the famous nuclear, you know, power plant there. And they captured a major airfield near Kyiv. That's Antonov International Airport, just about 25 miles from the capital. Now, in that case, it does look like the Ukrainian military has recaptured that airfield, at least for the time being. But that's becoming a big flashpoint. There are also reports that Russian troops were advancing on the eastern city of Kharkiv. That's Ukraine's second largest city, and apparently the Russians have it nearly surrounded right now. And then the mayor of Odessa, that's a large Ukrainian port city on the Black Sea, he said Odessa had been attacked a great deal on Thursday, but that Ukrainian forces have so far been able to repel the Russians there. He said that they shot down five Russian jets and a helicopter. So I expect the fighting there to really intensify today. But this is a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this yesterday in the Trumpet Brief, and he wrote, quote, "Many people believed that war in 21st century Europe was impossible, that conflict of this magnitude and consequence belonged to history. But here we are on the cusp of what could become the most significant war since World War II. So, you know, just a very powerful assessment of the situation there. And if you look at the facts on the ground in Ukraine right now, it's plain to see how accurate that is.
It's amazing to see the footage that is coming out of Ukraine right now. There's airstrikes, soldiers on the ground, and just a very brutal assault that is taking place here. What is the reporting on just how bad the casualties are getting?
Yeah, the bodies are already beginning to pile up. Just a couple of hours ago, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he said 137 Ukrainian civilians and military personnel have been killed so far as a result of this Russian invasion, and about 316 people have been injured. I've seen some of that video footage that you mentioned of, you know, various aspects of this attack, Russian missiles striking parts of the country and things like that, and it's just gut-wrenching to see it. I've also been talking every day to a contact in Kyiv, the capital city. He's a political commentator named Taras Revenets, and he's shown me some footage that he has personally taken of a missile attack on Ukraine's military intel headquarters in Podil, right there next to the capital. Just a few minutes ago, he said, quote, "They're getting closer and closer to Kyiv. It's going to be an unforgettable night," end quote. And just one small phrase substitution there. But it's a very sobering to talk with him every day. He's watching this invasion from his window. So, you know, just to hear about the fear and the anger in Ukraine right now is very impacting. The Ukrainians view this as totally unprovoked and entirely avoidable. But here we are. And then on the other side of it, the Ukrainian military says that they've killed at least 50 Russian soldiers so far. So it's too early to be able to confirm all of this. And of course, the situation is fast moving. But these latest figures, I think, should actually be added to all of the fighting that Russia has provoked in Ukraine since 2014, because this has been simmering here for about 7 or 8 years. So that would put the death count well over 12,000 people. And if the last couple of days have been, you know, a reliable indicator, that number could rapidly rise in the days and weeks ahead.
So let's talk about what we can discern of Putin's strategy here based on what he is, where he's concentrating his forces. You're talking about a fairly rapid advance toward the capital city. What do you think we can discern about what Putin is trying to accomplish?
Yeah, that's the big question here. Everyone wonders how far he'll go. What's the end game? What's the ultimate plan? Will he seize the capital and, you know, decapitate the government, topple President Zelensky and install sort of a pro-Russian puppet? There was a senior U.S. defense official who spoke about this yesterday, and he pointed out that if you look at all the different troop movements of the Russians right now, they are, quote, clearly designed to take key population centers and to topple Ukraine's democratically elected pro-Western government. So that seems to be, you know, a very logical outcome of this. But we are just witnessing a brutal act of aggression, a criminal war of premeditated and unjustified aggression. When I spoke yesterday with Mr. Revenets, he said he believes Putin's endgame is Finlandization, basically repeating what the Soviet Union did to Finland during the Cold War. And that was just making clear to the Finns that they had to support everything the Soviet Union did at all times, or else they would swiftly lose their sovereignty and political system. So it's just kind of a geopolitical bullying process by one more powerful nation against a less powerful one. And you could see that if Russia neutered Ukraine, installed a pro-Russian government, and stripped it of all resistance to Moscow, then that would really bring it under Putin's thumb and accomplish his goals there. So that, I think, is a likely outcome of this. There's also a possibility that if the US and Europe don't stand up to Russia, then in a short time, there may be no Ukraine. You know, it could be fully absorbed. We really don't know at this time. But Mr. Fleury wrote about this kind of ultimate goal as well in his article. He said, quote, "We don't know just how or when the present war with Ukraine will end. Putin might stop over the next day or two, content with merely beating Ukraine into submission, or he could continue with a full-scale invasion, taking over the nation entirely. End quote. So, you know, as for the end game, I think we just have to stand by for the time being.
Richard, what are the main takeaways that you have from seeing this unfold over the last day and a half?
Well, like Jeremiah said, this has been a massive shock for Europe. There's been a lot of people looking at this saying, you know, this is the biggest, potentially the biggest armed conflict we've had in the European continent since the end of World War II. This is the type of conflict that we didn't think we had anymore, that we thought we'd found ways to do away with through diplomacy and trade, et cetera, et cetera. So it has been just a global wake-up call, but especially a European wake-up call. You know, this is going to leave Russian forces potentially right up on the border. Well, they're already on the border in Poland with Belarus, but still on the border of Poland, pushing forwards into Europe. So there's a real sense of being shaken. And you see that especially within Germany. One of the biggest or most dramatic responses has come from basically the head of the German military, Lieutenant General Mais. And he went on a bit of a rant on his LinkedIn account, basically just complaining about how useless he felt that the German army was right now. He said, in my 41 years of peacetime service, I would have not have thought that I would have to experience a war. And the Bundeswehr, the army which I have the honor to command, is standing there more or less empty-handed. The options we can offer the government in support of the alliance are extremely limited. This does not feel good. I'm fed up. NATO territory is not yet under direct threat. Even if our partners in the East feel a constant growing pressure. When, if not now, is the time to put the Afghanistan mission behind us structurally and materially and to reposition ourselves? You know, we need to make some big changes. And he is definitely not the only one saying this. His response was certainly the most unusual. You don't see generals typically in Germany making such political statements, but a plea from him, look, we need a stronger German army in response to what we're seeing on our borders right now. And other people have been saying that. The finance minister, Christian Lindner, he said, we need to get used to the fact that our armed forces have been managed down to depletion for many, many years. You know, we need to turn this around. The current defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, she told Spiegel that Germany needs to raise our defense spending. She said on TV that the invasion is a turning point for German defense. She said, I worry that we have neglected the armed forces so much in the past that it can't completely fulfill its duty. Falling defense spending no longer fits with the times. So there's we're just days after the invasion, but there's already a clear sense that Europe needs to turn around its military, and especially Germany needs to turn around its military. And you know, it's not just Germany saying this. That's definitely where I think the focus is the strongest. But all across Europe, and not just on the military either. Bild was talking about the lack of, that Europe needs just to be stronger on the world scene. They wrote, this is Germany's largest newspaper. In recent years, Germany has always believed only in the power of diplomacy. But guys like Putin don't care about diplomacy. They only take you seriously if you carry a gun under your diplomatic suit. Putin's strength is a result of our weakness. The Standard, another German outlet, on February 10th, they said the EU finally needs a leader who can deal with Putin and Biden on equal footing. So, you know, they're looking at this all across Europe and they're saying we need stronger military. We need to have a gun under our suit. We need a strong leader. We need to be more unified. So it has been an electric shock to Europe.
Now, for someone who has followed the trumpet for some time, you can't help but think back to 2004, Russian election frightens Europe, January issue of the Trumpet, when Putin came to power. We've had several incidents that have taken place where Putin has advanced through portions of Europe. I'm looking at the cover of our 2014 May-June issue, Running from Russia, the cover story, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe. You have this Russian bear and all of these people that are fleeing from it, and then they're fleeing to the German eagle. And this call for more robust military leadership and political leadership within Europe, this has been a repeated theme in European politics as a response to Russian aggression over a period of years. And we've had this conversation before that this is essentially what Gerald Fleury has been talking about now for, you know, nearly two decades. How is what is happening right now and the comments that you're hearing from prominent leaders within Europe an intensification of what we've been hearing for some time?
So first of all, it's important to note that these previous events have already brought about changes. I was just looking over some statistics for the World Watch yesterday for our Trumpet print magazine on European defense spending. And in country after country, the trend is incredibly clear and incredibly consistent. You look at defense spending all across Europe, and at the end of the Cold War, for a couple of decades, it was shrinking. It was going down. And in the last few years, just about all across the board, it's ticked up again. You've got a neat little hockey stick diagram for just about every single European country. So defense spending has already turned around. It's already stopped shrinking. It's already gone beyond being stationary, and it's started to rise again. You've also seen a European Union that has come close together. You're seeing German troops being deployed in Lithuania right now and in the Baltic states right now. When that first happened, that was a big deal. Now it's not even news that they're sending more troops in response to what is happening. So we already have seen changes. What this makes clear is that these changes are not enough. And not only that, but they're not even the right kind of order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. That it needs something a whole lot more dramatic than a turnaround in defense spending and an increase of a few percentage points or a few hundred troops going to Latvia, or a European armed forces that is just some kind of shared budget that can be used to spend on joint infrastructure projects. It's a wake-up call that says we need something a whole lot more if we're going to stand up to Vladimir Putin. Mr. Fleury, in the Daniel Unlocks Revelation booklet, he talks in there about how we have this tendency to live in an unrealistic world, you know, where especially Britain and America, we think we live in this world where everyone is basically good and we all just want to get along and we all just want to kind of be able to trade and get rich and fat and happy. And he talks about in that book, well, the Bible describes a lot of these empires as beasts, you know, the big aggressive powers that plot to destroy each other. And maybe for not maybe European leaders, but maybe European citizens, they've kind of adopted that same British American mindset a little bit, looking at this world. And it's a wake up call that no, we live in a world of beasts. We live in a world where strength matters. And well, Thucydides, the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. That's the real world. So this is rapidly waking Europe up to the real world. And the fact that people are making all of these calls within just days, I think, shows you've got more to come. So, you know, Mr. Fleury, you mentioned some of those warnings that he made in the past. In 2014, this is one of the ones that most probably we cite the most after that Crimea crisis, back when Russia took Crimea. He said, we've been prophesying for about 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. And who knows how much it will take for that to happen. But we're talking about epic changes to Europe. You know, Europe coming together under one man, the French, Italians, Poles, all deciding to come under one German strongman. That's a huge deal. And there's going to be more to it than just a military crisis. But that's a major change. You've got armies that have been fighting each other for centuries, if not potentially millennia, coming together and forming a united force. So we're forecasting some major changes, even the European Union shrinking down from this 27 state to a much more tightly integrated 10 nation combine. Big changes are coming to Europe. It will take big events to make that happen. But what we've seen in Ukraine is an event of that kind of a magnitude. And so we can certainly expect some dramatic responses from Europe.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We will link to that that article, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe, that has so many of those powerful quotes. And also an article by Josue Michels, Europe is at War, that points back to some of those statements that Gerald Fleury has made over the years. And that is Europe's reaction to Russia's attack on Ukraine. Let's look now in the other direction to Russia's close partner, China. What are they saying about Putin's adventurism? For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah.
Yeah, well, most of the world, of course, is looking on aghast at this. Most of the world is just horrified that Russia would be engaging in this stunning, you know, seemingly anachronistic behavior. This attack, it does expose Vladimir Putin as the authoritarian dictator that he is. And of course, it's not just Ukrainians, but many Eastern Europeans that are extremely worried. And leaders from nations around the world have just vehemently condemned Putin's murderous aggression here. But China has refused to condemn this. Yesterday, China's assistant foreign minister was asked by reporters several times about whether China views Russia's attack as an invasion. And the question was repeatedly avoided. Finally, in response to one very persistent reporter, the foreign minister was visibly frustrated and said, quote, "The U.S. has been fueling the flame, fanning up the flame. How do they want to put out the fire?" End quote. So forget about Putin's tanks and tens of thousands of soldiers and the scores of Ukrainians, including civilians, who have been, you know, killed by Putin's forces already. Forget all of that. The U.S. has been fanning the flame. How? We don't know. The Chinese foreign minister didn't say. So this is, you know, it's still couched in diplomatic language. And China actually does have a fairly robust relationship with Ukraine. So they're in a bit of a tight spot here. But despite all of that, it's clear that China will not condemn this Russian brutality, this, you know, just utterly unnecessary brutality from Russia. And that does equate to tacit support from China. With a matter like this, there's really not much nuance. There's not a lot of room to contextualize and qualify. So I think it should be very simple for any world leader who respects the sovereignty of other nations to say, yes, this was a violation. But China can't do it, because the truth is the Chinese Communist Party is in bed with Russia and they support this Russian brutality.
No surprise, given just how close those two nations have been. That's something that we've been talking about in light of biblical prophecy, the relationship between Russia and China, very explicitly explained in prophecy. And we've written quite a lot about that. We have our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. We're seeing a similar trend or a similar response from another giant of Asia, India.
Yes, this was a real disappointment for me, you know, in some ways, because India tries to portray itself as a reliable U.S. partner. It's a member of the Quad, you know, the big group led by the U.S. that is intent on curbing Chinese aggression. India is a major trade partner to the U.S. and so many other Western nations, major weapons purchaser for the U.S. as well. But here we are getting a glimpse of the true face of India's leadership, because just like China, the leadership of India has refrained from condemning this open act of barbarism from Russia. Other U.S. allies have lined up to denounce this murderous attack, but India's ambassador to the United Nations was asked about it and said, yes, it's a matter of concern, but he stopped short of criticizing Putin or Russia in any way. So, you know, the other Quad members especially have made clear that this is despicable and they're totally on board with whatever punitive measures against Russia the U.S. decides to go with, but India can't do it. And I think that's an alarming indication of where India really stands in the global order. They've long bought just a stunning amount of weaponry from Russia. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Putin have built a very close personal relationship as well. And now we see that the Indians, they cannot condemn evil, even when it stares them in the face like this. So just a very disturbing and a very telling decision there.
Well, put this in prophetic context for us. With Russia, China, India, three major pillars of a prophesied Asian alliance, this kind of a cooperation among them really does fulfill that prophecy beautifully.
It does, yeah. And one fascinating aspect of this is that it's playing out exactly as it did back in 2014. When Vladimir Putin's Russia first invaded Ukraine. At that time, of course, he took the Crimean Peninsula. And at that time, China and India did essentially the same thing that we're seeing now, making clear that they supported Putin's expansionism. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory wrote an article about it at that time. It's in our May-June 2014 issue. And part of that article says, China and India, these Asian powerhouses, have made clear that they support Putin. This is a stunning fulfillment of a biblical prophecy. When these Asian nations, extremely powerful nuclear-armed countries, begin to show solidarity with each other regarding moves like that, what does that portend for the world? I tell you, it is woe to the world. It will cause many serious problems. And from there, Mr. Flory gets into exactly what prophecy he's talking about. He especially focuses on Revelation 9:16, which talks about how in the end time, there will be a massive group of Asian nations. It'll be led by what's called the Prince of Russia, if you look at Ezekiel 38. And then in this passage here in Revelation, it says that it'll field an army of 200 million soldiers. So that's far more than Russia could ever field on its own. Russia doesn't even have that many total people. But once you factor in China and India, the world's two most populous countries, well over, you know, a billion people in each one, then it's very easy to see how you can get those to those kinds of numbers for a military very quickly. So to see China and India right now rallying behind Putin, that's it's just really laying the groundwork, I think, for these Asian giants to all be grouped together in this end time alliance. And it shows how this powerhouse will have just a very staggeringly potent military force.
We will link to that article, Asia Stands with Putin. It is quite extraordinary to see that prophecy fulfilled in such a dramatic way. And it's definitely worth looking into, as well as our booklet, Russia and China and Prophecy. We just got a word this morning that that booklet on thetrumpet.com actually had a spike in interest, mostly from our organic Google traffic, apparently, as well as an article that Gerald Flory wrote, The Ukraine Crisis Was Prophesied, back in 2014. So there is quite a lot of interest in these prophecies, and interest that is well-placed. I would encourage you to take a look at those resources. Thanks for that. Now, as Asia gets behind Putin, the Western world really is alarmed to see Russia resorting to warfare on this scale. But what are they going to do about it? Let's look now at the broader picture of Western response to this aggression. Is there anyone to support the Ukrainians to stop Putin from having his way? For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Well, there are lots of people willing to stand up and give Vladimir Putin a good telling off. And to me, this just is the perfect symbol of so much of the Western response. Is number 10 Downing Street last night, and the European Commission building in Brussels were lit up in blue and yellow, the Ukrainian colors. A nice gesture, maybe, but I'm pretty sure Ukraine would rather guns and anti-tank missiles or soldiers to come help them fight. But that to me just encapsulates the Western response, where we will make these gestures. We will tweet with hashtag Ukraine. But that's about it. Even Joe Biden himself, he used to boast about how tough he was and about how he would use sanctions to stop Russia and bring Russia to its knees. Well, when he was introducing these sanctions in his press conferences, he said no one expected the sanctions to prevent anything from happening. You know, the sanctions themselves are kind of just another gesture of just, you know, lighting up the government buildings in orange and blue to show that we stand with Ukraine. It doesn't actually do anything to stop Russia, but it shows that we support Ukraine and that we condemn Vladimir Putin. And that really is about it. And part of the reason is that Russia has done a good job of preparing for economic warfare. There are things that the West can do to hurt Russia, but there are things that Russia can do to hurt us. And I think a lot of leaders have calculated that they don't want that cost, and that we, the voters, don't have the will to sustain that kind of cost for standing up for Vladimir Putin. That we're all kind of the same way. We might tweet hashtag Ukraine and light up in yellow and blue, but we're not prepared to pay twice as much for our utility bills in the winter. We're not prepared to pay more than we have ever paid in our lives for filling up our cars with gas. There's the potential for food shortages, this vast amounts of food coming from Russia and Ukraine. There's a fertilizer shortage already right now, and Russia has probably the world's largest supplies and a massive stockpile of fertilizer. So if we go too hard in terms of sanctions on Russia, we face food shortages for quite a long time to come. There's ingredients and things used in the creation of semiconductors. We've already got a semiconductor shortage, and that's cropping up in all kinds of weird areas, like rental car shortages and even shortages of farming equipment. Well, there's some key components used in semiconductors that Russia has got a good control of. There's key ones as well that come right from southeastern Ukraine, right from this area where the fighting is happening. I think it's something like 90% of the world's neon comes from exactly that area. So if we go too hard and hurt Vladimir Putin, he can hurt us too. And this kind of weakness is something that Mr. Flurry focused on in his article that we've got up on the website right now. Bible prophecy comes alive in Ukraine. He goes over so many of those key prophecies about who this individual Vladimir Putin is, how he plays in to Bible prophecy. But he also talks about how Western weakness and British and American weakness has allowed this. He quotes what he wrote in that back in that Prophesied Prince of Rosh booklet. It says the Ukrainian attack was an audacious move by Russia. America did nothing. Russia's become so weak it wouldn't even support the Ukrainian protesters with strong words. And we're doing the same thing again. And each time we respond that way, it just makes Vladimir Putin bolder. It just makes him pushier. It just makes him think he can get away with more. And I've seen so many people saying, oh, Vladimir Putin's made a big mistake now. He's really going to get punished for this. He's gone too far. They said that last time in 2014, and nobody really did anything. Why is that? Nothing that has been announced so far has gone far beyond symbolism. But even weaker than Britain and the United States has been Europe's response, and this is part of the reason why even America's response has been weak. Where we did see Germany, giving credit where credit's due, come out and suspend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, this pipeline that we've talked about for a long time that undermines NATO. They've been building this pipeline with Russia. They refused to say they were permanently canceling it, but they were suspending the paperwork necessary for it to run. So we'll have to see how that plays out. It's a piece of paper that they're withholding, so they could reinstate that piece of paper at a moment's notice. But Europe has they've immediately started talking about, okay, well, we need to sanction Russia. You know, we need this gesture, this symbolism to show that it's a bad thing. As soon as Europe starts talking about that, each European country starts popping up and saying, but not this, because that would hurt us. You know, Italy pops up, not luxury goods. Can't sanction luxury goods because that would hurt our luxury good industry. Germany pops up, well, we can't sanction oil and gas. Fine, we're not using Nord Stream 2, but we've got a whole bunch of other pipelines from Russia. We depend on them for most of our oil and most of our gas, a good chunk of our oil. We can't sanction them on energy. And so you end up with a package that takes ages to debate out, and at the end of the day accomplishes nothing because nobody wants it to inconvenience them. This is where the biggest area this comes in is with the SWIFT payment system. You know, this has been the area where the big area that was Vladimir Putin was going to get punished if he invaded Ukraine. All along, Joe Biden has been trying to say, well, we'd like to kick him out of the SWIFT payment system, this international currency payment system. And this would really hurt. No Russia, no money for Russia. Whole economy cut off from the international bank's payment system. And Europe stopped that from happening. Germany successfully stopped that from being a threat all the way in the run up to this invasion. They said, well, we don't think we should go that far. And right now they are saying, no, we don't want this to happen. And Joe Biden is listening to them. And so Europe is successfully preventing. I think there's an open question how bad these sanctions would be, but certainly the worst kind of sanction that's being talked about is being stopped by Europe.
So it's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin made a good gamble in going into Ukraine, that he sees what's going on in the world. He sees the weakness in these nations, and he feels pretty confident that he's able to act with impunity and not fear a whole lot of repercussions from these other nations. The interesting thing is, when you look at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, the weakness that you see in the United States and Britain is taking one trajectory. The weakness that you see in Europe, as bad as it is, harken back to the second segment that we, when we spoke about just this need within Europe for greater military, greater leadership, prophecy shows us that that's going to take a very different course.
That's right. You've got this interesting trend in Europe where absolutely Europe fears Russia. And they are convicted of the need to make major changes. But you've had this break taking place between Germany and the United States, and that fundamentally Germany is no longer on the same side as the United States. They would like America out of Europe so that they can rise up and really lead Europe. And they also see, much as they fear Vladimir Putin, they see Vladimir Putin as a way to make that happen. As Russia rises in power, he can push the United States out, leaving Germany to stand up and take the lead. And so that's where you get this both fearful and then kind of weak and almost enabling response, where they enable Vladimir Putin to really act powerfully and help split the NATO alliance. And this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flowey explained in an earlier article almost a month ago, why Germany just betrayed America. The quip for that, siding with Russia regarding Ukraine, exposes Germany's secret deal and dangerous intentions. In this weak response, in this refusal to confront Russia, and in this constant hampering of what NATO is doing. And remember, Germany has been hampering NATO's defense for weeks up until now. You know, they've been refusing to sell them weapons. They've been blocking other countries from selling them weapons. I was reading a story just this week where they happened to arrest a Georgian general who's now a Ukrainian citizen. He was one of Georgia's top generals when Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. He could have been a huge asset this week, except he's under house arrest in Germany. There are all these things that Germany has been doing that have led to this situation and that have undermined the Western response in this situation, undermined Ukraine in this situation. So you can see them working on this other side. And in that article, Mr. Flowey goes over what history says about this. There's this historical tendency for Germany to work hand in hand with Russia, and what Bible prophecy reveals about this betrayal that is coming from Germany. The Bible talks about the way that that America really trusts Europe and really trusts Germany, and says that they're going to be stabbed in the back. And you see that happening in outline with what's going on in Ukraine. So that is another way that Bible prophecy is coming alive in this crisis. And that article is called "Why Germany Just Betrayed America."
Well, thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at some other stories, non-Ukraine stories, including the final stages of the Iran nuclear negotiations, Israel's deep state trying to cover its tracks over recent corruption exposure, Canada's crackdown on freedom, and revelations that COVID vaccines are a massive money-making scheme. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Iran nuclear negotiations could conclude with a deal as early as next week. For this story, we'll turn to Joshua Taylor.
Iran's top negotiator actually returned to Tehran for his final consultation. So we can be seeing, as you said, a deal as early as next week. And by all accounts, this deal is just another JCPOA, another original nuclear deal similar to what was negotiated under President Barack Obama. And it's actually, from all accounts, even worse. Reuters came out with a draft of that deal, and it has a list of things going with it that is just so much worse than the first one. Currently, under the new deal, Iran's violations that it's had recently and its illegal nuclear activity will be whitewashed. Iran will not have to destroy any of its advanced nuclear centrifuges that it has created recently. It can instead just store those. It will be granted hundreds of billions of dollars in sanctions relief and unfrozen assets. It'll be welcomed back into the international market, and it will get to keep its illegal ballistic missile program. That isn't even addressed this time. And the path for the bomb is being laid out for them quite clearly. The original dates for the original nuclear deal will be kept, meaning that we could see Iran legally allowed to get a bomb within the next 2.5 years. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has been adamant that Israel will not accept Iran being a nuclear threshold state. But in terms of actual actions, we're not seeing too much from the Israel side of things. And looking back at Iran, it's kind of comical because Iran's supreme leader has claimed in a recent speech that its nuclear program is not seeking to any military use. It's seeking to be 100% peaceful. But the facts are that there is no civilian use for highly enriched uranium, which Iran is pushing for. Civilian use for uranium is about 3-5%. Right now, Iran is pushing towards 60%. And with Iran, they're seeking as well to be able to impose a legal way to hold the U.S. to this new deal, even across administrations, which at the moment Biden can't legally do. But so Iran's seeking to be able to do that in such a way as if the U.S. were to pull out once again from this new deal, they would then immediately allow it to jump right back to their current 60% enrichment rate. Mm.
It's not hard to see a connection with, we heard assurances from Vladimir Putin that he would not invade Ukraine. He had absolutely no interest in invading Ukraine, probably just a couple of days before he invaded Ukraine with all of his might, to hear the Ayatollah saying that we have absolutely no interest in nuclear weapons and insist that this is entirely for civilian purposes, that they're a very peaceful nation. They have showed by their actions time after time after time that they cannot be trusted. It's remarkable to think of all of these negotiators from various nations sitting around a table with Iranian representatives and laying out all of these terms in a way that are so favorable to Iran and really guarantee the fact that it's going to become a nuclear power.
Yeah, at the end of the day, most of the negotiators on the American side of things are the exact same negotiators that were under Obama. So all the same, the reason why this deal looks so much like the old deal is exactly because it is Obama's negotiating team. And they are pushing that exact same set of deals, the same set of conditions, because they are looking to give basically Iran the bomb. Mr. Joe Flurry has talked a lot about that, how this is all this is all an attack on America. This is the Obama administration, the Joe Obama administration, trying to push this kind of foreign policy so that Iran can get the bomb.
He called it the worst foreign policy disaster in America's history, the initial nuclear deal that America made with Iran. This is 2.0, and it's, you're saying, worse than the first one.
Absolutely. It's the same one, but even less powerful, even less restrictive. One of the big things with this now is there, unlike the last one where you had the possibility of snapback sanctions, this new deal removes even that mechanism. There is no way for the international community, under the terms that we've seen with the Reuters news piece, for any nation to bring these snapback sanctions.
Well, we will link to that article, The Worst Foreign Policy Disaster in America's History, for more prophetic context to what we see happening with the negotiators making this deal with Iran and just how dangerous it is. It's so important that we recognize that a nuclear Iran really will accelerate the fulfillment of biblical prophecy that concerns that nation. We thank you very much for that, Joshua. Up now to Canada. It feels like it was so long ago, but with everything that's happened this week, but it was just a few days ago that the Justin Trudeau government went full totalitarian against the protesters there. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it was actually just after we recorded Trumpet Hour last Friday that the capital of Canada became a war zone, basically. This actually probably would have been our biggest war zone coverage this week if Vladimir Putin hadn't invaded Ukraine shortly thereafter. But as those who've been following this program for any amount of time know, there had been these protests in Canada against these vaccine mandates, forcing truckers to get vaccinated if they wanted to keep their job, or saying you can't cross the border if you don't get the vaccines. You had this huge convoy that said they were going to stay in Ottawa, Canada, until these mandates were lifted. And so it was last Monday, and we talked about this a little bit on not this Monday, but Monday of last week. And we talked a little bit about the program last week, that Justin Trudeau did something that was only been done three times in Canadian history, and basically invoked war powers that was only ever been done before during World War I and World War II, which makes sense. And then also by Justin's father to crack down on some Quebec separatists in the 70s. But he invoked these war measures on February 14th, and then on February 18th, sent police into Ottawa to disperse these crowds. And I mean, they weren't gentle. They weren't gentle about it either. That, I mean, tear gas, you've got pepper spray, you've got batons, you've got video footage of like an old Indian woman with a walker being trampled by Canadian police on horseback. They've actually had some pretty shocking revelations from Rebel News Canada, where they got hold of some text messages or some screenshots between the Royal Canadian Mounted Police involved in this crackdown, even like saying that they really wanted to hurt these truckers. They had just a despising of these truckers, where one of them was telling the other, he's like, well, don't kick them all out this week because next week's group wants a turn to beat up on these people. And then probably the most shocking one said, time for the protesters to hear our jackboots on the ground. And so, just disperse these protests. Congress came in, not Congress, Parliament, the Canadian Parliament came in after the crackdown and approved this Emergency Powers Act, which is almost assuredly used illegal. I mean, this is a peaceful protest, not a war. But basically confirmed that if Trudeau wants to do this again, he had majority support in Parliament for it. Mm-hmm. And once Trudeau found that out, I mean, he was getting quite a bit of flack from the international community, with even like the Wall Street Journal calling him a tin pot dictator, people comparing him to Hitler, people comparing him to various communist dictators around the world, including Fidel Castro and a late dictator of Romania. So he did come in finally this Wednesday and revoke the War Powers Act before the 30 days had expired, because he didn't need it anymore. He dispersed those who challenged his authority, and Parliament had approved his ability to do so.
Remarkable to see that happening in Canada. We have an excellent article by Abraham Blondeau with a lot of footage he included in this article about how police brutally cracked down on Freedom Convoy protesters. We'll link to that in the show notes. Take a look at that. And it also gets into the prophetic ramifications of this lurch toward totalitarianism in Canada, and puts it in the context of how this is happening. Similar things are happening in other English-speaking nations. We'll link to that article by Abraham Blondeau in the show notes for the program today. Thanks for that, Andrew. We spoke recently on this program about revelations that Israeli police used illegal means to surveil former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to take him down politically. Well, now we're seeing the cover-up for this story. We'll go back to Joshua Taylor.
This week, the Israel police commissioner came out and made an announcement saying that the police found no indications that they had illegally hacked the mobile phones of anybody using the Pegasus software. And they stress very highly that that it wasn't done illegally. The critical thing to note is that at no point are they denying that they didn't or that they used it. We actually even have testimony from the prosecutors that are going after Mr. Netanyahu saying that they found that Pegasus was used at least once to obtain information for that for his trial. The police chief is coming out quite strongly as well. He is very adamant. If you watch him give this announcement, he's very impassioned. Quoting him, he says, the Israel police have been falsely accused, serious allegations that have severely damaged not only public confidence in the police, but in all law enforcement agencies. And then skipping down, he says that the way that this is going about, these false reports are hurting the state's attorney's office, the judiciary, and really all state authorities. So he's coming out, he's saying that this is the wrong, that if there was any wrongdoing, he would personally go after those people, regardless of their rank or position. But it really does sound, when you listen to this and you read the coverage, that the justice ministry does protest too much, methinks. And in addition to that, just going through, the Jewish News Syndicate had a great article about this so far, including a quote from a senior lecturer at the Friedman School of Public Policy at Hebrew University. And he said that they have overstepped the warrants in a few cases, and that there are and that these warrants against civilians, that no warrants for using cyber weapons against citizens, no judge can issue such a warrant. He said that they say that the information gathered was not used in the trial. If I robbed a bank and I didn't buy anything with the money, does that mean I didn't rob the bank? This is a ridiculous argument. And he also notes how that the left-wing mainstream press has been actively trying to bury this story. And the police and the prosecution for against Mr. Netanyahu are responding to these accusations with political spin. And in addition to that, Mr. Netanyahu's lawyers have hinted that they have more information that will be forthcoming about the case.
Well, it's worth taking a look at that article by Brad McDonald from a couple of weeks back. Israel's deep state is being exposed. Really, the perspective that the Trumpet offers on this is totally unique because of the spiritual dimension to what we're seeing in these events, both in the United States and in Israel. It's amazing to recognize the parallels between those two. But we will link to Mr. McDonald's article in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Joshua. We sent our newest Trumpet print edition to press yesterday. The cover story is an article by Andrew Miller, Running on COVID Money, the subhead, How Big Government, Big Pharma, and Big Media Colluded to Terrify the Public and Make a Fortune. Well, some more revelations have come out on just how much money these folks have been making through these vaccines. For this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the timing on these new revelations were pretty convenient, at least pretty convenient for me, because I'd been working on this article for about a week and I was almost finished with it when I had something pretty important to add, where the head Project Veritas had sent an undercover reporter to go on a series of dinner dates with Christopher Cole, who's an executive at the Food and Drug Administration. And he was pretty frank in these conversations. He didn't know he was being recorded, about just what a money-making scheme these vaccines are, where he has two statements I'd like to focus on primarily in the little bit of time we have left, where one of the statements he said is that Biden wants to inoculate as many people as possible, so you'll have to get an annual shot. I mean, it hasn't been formally announced yet because we don't want to rile everyone up, but yeah, you're going to have to get an annual shot. And so he's basically admitting that like Pfizer, who's the biggest vaccine maker, they made $34 billion last year. They're expecting to make $50-something billion this year off vaccines alone. And they've doubled their size, which means they want to keep that money going. So they're pressing hard to get the Biden administration to actually make you get these shots every year, so they can make that $50 billion every year instead of a one-and-done thing. Which, that, like I said, that hasn't been publicly announced yet, but that secret video recording is just shocking. And then he made the other statement that was so shocking. He didn't do this at the same dinner date. This was a couple days later, where he expounded. He said, "This will be a fountain of revenue. If they can get every person required to get an annual shot, that's a reoccurring return of money. The drug companies, the food companies, the vaccine companies, they pay us, the FDA, hundreds of millions of dollars a year to hire and keep reviewers to approve their products." So he's basically saying that these big companies, they're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to the FDA to approve an experimental vaccine that's looks like it's giving people blood clots and even killing them in many cases, so that they can make legally require everyone to get one shot a year, so Pfizer can make $54 billion in revenue from here to the foreseeable future.
I'm pretty excited about this new Trumpet edition, and I think the cover story that that Andrew Miller wrote is excellent. Again, the title of that article is Running on COVID Money. That'll be up available on the website next week. And really, the whole first half of the magazine, with the exception of a short article from the editor by Gerald Fleury about the Durham investigation, the whole front half of the magazine is about several of the implications of what has happened through the vaccines and the coronavirus response. We have a huge feature article from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, titled, Was the Coronavirus Crisis Engineered? That is quite explosive. So really brings up some damning information about the Biden administration, and even pointing back to Barack Obama as well. So do watch for that. That'll be up on the website next week. In the meantime, you can read Andrew Miller's article up right now, Project Veritas Reveals Vaccine Money-Making Agenda. We'll link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Joshua Taylor. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Aesop. We hang the petty thieves and appoint the great ones to public office. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.